Welcome to The Peg Doesn't Fit, the podcast that brings you the change makers in education. Tune in to hear from educational leaders who aren't content with the status quo educational model and are blazing their own path. All right, welcome everybody to The Peg Doesn't Fit. We are on episode 3. We've got Carrie McDonald here, and I'm going to read her awesome bio. Carrie is a senior education fellow at FEE and a host of the weekly Liberate Ed podcast. She's also the author of Unschooled, Raising Curious, Well-Educated Children Outside the Conventional Classroom, an adjunct scholar at the Cato Institute, education policy fellow at the State Policy Network, and a regular Forbes contributor. Carrie's research interests include homeschooling and schooling alternatives, self-directed learning, education entrepreneurship, parent empowerment, school choice, and family and child policy. Her articles have appeared at the Wall Street Journal, Newsweek, NPR, Education Next, Reason Magazine, City Journal, Entrepreneur, and Journal of School Choice, among others. She has a master's degree in education policy from Harvard University and a bachelor's degree in economics from,
Bowdoin College. Yeah.
Okay. Carrie lives in Cambridge, Massachusetts with her husband and 4 children. Carrie, welcome to the show.
Oh, it's great to be with you, Ryan. Thanks for having me.
Thank you. I am a bit of a fanboy ever since I listened to your audiobook this summer.
It helped.
I fell down this... Well, I'm in public education still, but I think I fell down briefly into the rabbit hole probably a decade ago, but then actually took the plunge, I'd say maybe a year ago. And so this summer, I spent a lot of time listening to audiobooks, yours among them, about just all that is out there when it comes to change in education. And what I love about this podcast is every one of you has somebody else I should either read a book from, follow, and just learn from. And with yours, you had Peter Gray do the foreword. So I also read his book, Free to Learn. And I don't know, it's just been fascinating. It's a really fun journey. And I noticed how similar our podcasts are. And I'm jealous of all the people you get to talk to. But I think so many of us educators don't realize how much innovation is out there. And I'm really grateful to have you on the show just to share your experience of how you came to this place and then tell us a little bit about what you're learning along the way. So tell us, what is your educational origin story? How did you get to being doing what you're doing right now?
Yeah, you know, I think my kind of entry point into alternative education really began back when I was an undergraduate in the late 1990s studying economics. I went to K-12 public schools and hadn't really thought much about kind of non-conventional forms of education. But then when I was studying economics and realizing kind of this one size fits all government run monopoly style of schooling, it started making me think, you know, why aren't there more choices, or what choices are available? What are people trying to take advantage of, and what could be scaled or expanded if there, you know, kind of wasn't this predominant one size fits all model kind of sort of running the show in terms of education throughout the US. And so that's really what started me thinking about education. I began taking some education classes as an undergraduate, looking at different kinds of models, as well as the lack of choices that a lot of families had in education. And so that my senior year as an undergraduate, this would have been in the late 1990s, I had a chance to do an independent research project for one of these education seminars. And I was interested in homeschooling. You know, I was, what is this? You know, I never knew a homeschooler, never knew much about homeschooling, But I had a classmate who had a family member that lived nearby who was homeschooling her child. And I thought, gee, that would be a really fascinating peek at this kind of different model that I was starting to explore. And so I remember that semester walking into that homeschooling family's home and being completely captivated by what I saw. It was an entirely different way of living and learning, really passion-centered, child-centered education, immersed in the larger community in sort of authentic socialization, which was quite different from the sort of artificial socialization that I was seeing, that I had experienced, obviously, in conventional public schools. And that I was seeing that same semester when I was doing a student teaching practicum in a local public elementary school with the same age children as this homeschool child. And I think it was that moment where I really saw kind of side by side this contrast between conventional forms of schooling that are much more around command and control models, you know, age segregated classrooms, the teacher as kind of the authoritarian person in the room, and a packaged curriculum that didn't allow for much personalization and individualization, and then compared that to what was very much an individualized education model with this homeschool child. And so that really, I think, was my on-ramp into becoming much more passionate about education and especially education policy. I went to, as you said, graduate school in education policy at Harvard, and became more and more interested not only in alternative education, but schooling alternatives and entirely, you know, not even just thinking about various types of education philosophies or different sort of, you know, models that might pop up, but could there be these schooling alternatives entirely that don't operate at all like conventional schools? And so I did that kind of on the side through kind of private work in grad school, but most of my time in grad school and the classes that I was interested in there focused around school choice. Is how do we expand school choice policies that enable education funding to follow students instead of going to school systems? And so I became much more interested in kind of policy from that perspective of really enabling families to have much more access to all kinds of education possibilities, whether that's different kinds of school, again, alternative education or schooling alternatives more generally. And so that's what I really, you know, have spent the past couple of decades working on. You know, obviously wrote the Unschooled book, but I spent a lot of my time kind of championing education entrepreneurship and innovation and these emerging K-12 learning models, as well as unschooling and self-directed education.
Excellent. Yeah, I noticed One term I've used, and I see you used it too in a recent article you wrote, is decentralized, like just essentially break apart those models we have of education must only be right here and in this public education behemoth that we have, sadly. And I'll get to a question related to that later. So unschooling is a term that's probably unfamiliar to a lot of us. What does that mean to you?
Yeah. So the way I define unschooling in the Unschooled book is really disentangling education from schooling, including sort of school at home versions of homeschooling, right? So if you're simply, and I think a lot of families sort of encountered this during the spring of 2020 when schools shut down and they all, you know, all of a sudden were, you know, homeschooling. But of course, in many cases, they were just changing the location of what was schooling to the home. And so unschooling really challenges that whole idea of what we think of as traditional models of schooling and recognizes that education is much bigger and much broader than that. And specifically, unschooling is a term or kind of a catch-all term for the idea of self-directed education, where you have young people being completely in charge of their own learning. There's no kind of required classes. There's no set evaluations or curriculum unless they're the ones kind of choosing to learn that or to be evaluated in a certain way. So it's really the absence of coercion in education, which is why it's really the opposite of all forms of conventional schooling today, both public and private.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I've heard the term from someone. I don't know if it was Matt Baudreau at Acton Academy, but somebody said, you know, essentially schooling and learning are not the same things. And we often pair those as the same. I think because we've so many, well, most everyone in the U.S. has grown up in the K-12 system in public education as a majority. And so that just becomes, well, of course, it's the way it should be almost. And to disconnect yourself is so tough. I think even as I share what I've learned and what it gets me excited, maybe you've experienced this the same too, that you get a little bit of resistance, like, yeah, but I don't know. There's just a lot of yeah, buts, I'll say that. Go ahead.
Yeah. I would just say that, you know, I think a lot of parents see the kind of natural creativity and curiosity that their young children experience, especially if they're not put into a kind of formal preschool at such a young age. They're able to see that young children are designed to learn and explore and discover. They're, of course, always asking why. Mm-hmm. They are always inquisitive, with this drive to discover what is around them. And I think, you know, this is something obviously that Peter Gray talks a lot about in Free to Learn and that I talk about in Unschooled. You know, those drives for learning don't just disappear when a child hits a certain age, like 5 or 6. Peter Gray would say it's our coercive system of schooling that shuts off those drives. Mm-hmm. And so with unschooling or self-directed education, the key is just simply not to shut off those drives, to allow children to continue to evolve and develop following their curiosities and their passions, rather than kind of imposing this top-down curriculum or top-down schooled expectations on them. And I think that's the piece, you know, that we might be able to sort of persuade others to think about schooling in a different way. If we say, you know, look at young children, that doesn't go away on its own. You know, it's what's happening to them in a conventional classroom that really erodes that natural curiosity and creativity. I mean, you think about it, when you go to school, its originality is trumped by obedience, and, you know, conformity trumps creativity. You're told not to color outside the lines. You know, you're told to, you know, sit quietly and answer questions that the teacher is directing at you. So you learn to be taught, essentially, and kind of conditioned in that way. And with self-directed education or unschooling, it's simply allowing the individual learner to continue that path of, you know, kind of self-actualization that they are beginning in their sort of younger years.
Mm-hmm. I think you almost have to unschool the teachers as well, because I know the model way back in Massachusetts, you know, what, 150, 200 years ago, was founded in the idea of the command and control and I'll say brainwashing kids to conform. However, yet, I think sometimes when they hear about these new models, they picture a world in which kids are running amok and doing whatever they want. And it's got this negative connotation, which to me feels like almost this intrinsic distrust of children that adults that are kind of stuck in these models carry with them. And I don't know if it's a protectionary device or what, but I'm sad when I hear that. And I'll admit, I probably had to come to grips with my own sense of that, both being as a parent and just as I fell down this rabbit hole, like, okay, what if kids could just learn whatever they wanted? Is that okay? You know, and yeah, I just wonder how much unschooling. What are your thoughts? Do teachers and adults need to be unschooled as well?
No, I think there's definitely that deconditioning that has to happen from adults. And of course, we've all been through this conventional model, most of us. And so it's no surprise that we would kind of wonder what happens in a much more free learning environment. But I think to your larger point, you know, people will say, oh, it sounds like unschooling or self-directed education sounds like a Lord of the Flies environment, where, as you say, kids are just running amok. And one of the key points that I make throughout the Unschooled book, as I traveled the country country and interviewed unschoolers, as well as those, you know, learning or running self-directed learning centers and what I call unschooling schools or Sudbury model schools that are modeled after the Sudbury Valley School that was founded in 1968 in Massachusetts. Is there is a clear focus on freedom with responsibility, or as A.S. Neal, who's the founder of the Summerhill School in England in 1921 and wrote the book Summerhill, is kind of the predecessor of the unschooling and self-directed education movement, he would say freedom, not license. And in fact, he had a book titled Freedom, Not License as well, that kind of expounded on this concept of what happens in self-directed education environments. And so there is this sense that, you know, you can have maximum freedom with personal responsibility. And so if you look at these, whether they're the learning centers or the Sudbury model schools, there's clear expectations around kind of community behavior and making sure that, as A.S. Neal would say, that my freedom doesn't negatively affect your freedom. And so there is that negotiation, there is that compromise in these communities. And the same would be, of course, true in homeschooling or unschooling families, that there would be this balance of needs. But the key is to really recognize that if we can provide young people with this maximum freedom to learn without this kind of top-down imposed curriculum that's often arbitrary, that often, you know, if you think about, for example, a curriculum today that's kind of dominant in the U.S., they'll say that, you know, there are certain milestones that you have to meet. Kids in kindergarten today are now expected to read, for example, in many cases, which is a shifting academic expectation. It simply didn't exist when you or I were probably in school. And now you know, there's data to suggest that teachers are now expecting young people to read. There's an interesting study came out of the University of Virginia with researchers there who asked teachers if in 1998, if children should be learning to read in kindergarten. And about 30% of the teachers said that in 1998, that said that they should in 1998. Fast forward to 2010, so just 12 years later, 80% of teachers said that kindergartners should be reading. And of course, this isn't the teachers that are changing. It's the academic pressure that they're feeling through the curriculum, through the testing, through the increasing standardization of learning. And so a lot of this kind of top-down curriculum is, you know, doesn't make developmental sense. Right. It is constantly changing, and you have these kind of new directives coming down and new sort of test-based curriculum expectations to be meeting. And I think that that's where we're seeing more and more interest in, today in alternative education models, whether it's self-directed education, kind of the purest form of non-coercive learning, or if it's micro-schools and other kinds of more personalized or individualized learning environments that still might use a conventional curriculum, but it's much more tailored to the child's individual needs. There's not these kind of arbitrary cutoffs for mastery. You know, the curriculum kind of follows the child as the child's developing. And I think that that's a good sign. It's sort of a backlash against this increasing standardization we find in conventional schooling.
Thank you. Well put. I guess that's your job too. Well, I want to get into the exciting part, because I feel like, you know, I said I fell down a rabbit hole. I felt like the incline got even steeper and more exciting when I discovered that this is your job, really, to just research and stay on top of educational innovation trends. That's how I perceive it. Would that be fair assessment?
Yeah, I mean, I have the best job in the world. I get to interview education entrepreneurs and micro school founders and kind of explore this alternative education world and tell their stories.
So where would you see, like, what gets you the most excited right now?
Well, for example, I just got back from a trip to South Florida, where there is this burgeoning ecosystem of education entrepreneurship. There, just in the kind of greater Fort Lauderdale area alone, there's more than 24 micro schools and hybrid homeschools and homeschooling programming. It's this incredible cluster of education, entrepreneurship, and innovation, kind of creating these low-cost private schools that are tailored, as I said earlier, to kind of individualized needs. They're focused on you know, mastery-based curriculum as opposed to kind of testing and standardized metrics. Some of these micro schools existed pre-2020, but a lot of them have expanded or have been created since then, and others have expanded since then as there's more demand by parents for individualized learning. I think parents got a close-up look at what was happening in their kids' schools in 2020. And a lot of them said, you know, we could do things better. And they were either teachers who went off and then created micro schools to do things better, or parents who did the same or found these micro schools. So I think that's been really exciting to see there, just this area that's growing. And I'll say another interesting piece that's happening in South Florida is a lot of these micro schools, you know, they tend to be lower cost than traditional private schools, often, you know, half or more of the cost of a traditional private school. So that makes them more accessible to more families just by nature of their lower tuition, but they're still often out of reach for a lot of families. And what is happening in Florida and other states across the country is greater access to school choice policies. Again, something that's even grown in popularity since 2020. But for sure, the micro schools that I talked to and I've spotlighted in some articles that are growing in South Florida, they really rely on the Florida scholarship programs, which enable many more families to access these programs, these micro schools, at little to no cost through these school choice policies that enable funding to go to families. And they will say, these education entrepreneurs and micro school founders, they will say, you know, well, we could exist without these school choice policies, but it would be, you know, a handful of students who could privately pay. And we want this kind of personalized learning environment and mastery-based curriculum to be available to many more students. And the only way to do that is through these school choice policies. So that's been really exciting to see just this energy and enthusiasm around schooling alternatives and innovation and this entrepreneurial spirit that's happening in South Florida and is happening elsewhere. You know, I'm kind of in the process of beginning to profile different clusters of education entrepreneurship around the country and figure out, you know, what is it about these specific places that's catalyzing some of this education entrepreneurship. I mean, in many cases, these are like little Silicon Valleys of education entrepreneurship, and what's happening there that's promoting that.
So how do you find out about these? Is it word of mouth, or what brings them to your brain or your desk?
Yeah, there's a few ways. I often have micro school founders reach out to me or other education entrepreneurs reach out to me. I find them through, you know, social media and other, you know, because I'm kind of tuned into this world. So I'm always interested in seeing what founders are doing. One program or organizations that's been really incredibly supportive for a lot of these school founders is the Vela Education Fund, which is a philanthropic nonprofit organization that provides micro grants to micro school founders and homeschooling collaboratives and co-learning spaces and hybrid schools and basically all of these unconventional models that are sprouting. And they have given, you know, grants out to almost 2,000 founders over the past couple of years, people really just running these small programs. It could be a homeschool co-op out of their home, but, you know, have a vision and want to be able to expand and reach more people. And just these little micro grants can go a huge way in terms of validating these entrepreneurs' vision and models, and then helping them additional funding as they can show growth or, you know, broader reach and so on. And then what's really neat is that Vela community, because now there have been so many micro grants released, there are these kind of clusters of education entrepreneurship around the Vela grant. So word of mouth will say, you know, my micro school founder might say, oh, I found out about this grant, you should apply. And then that person applies. And then just that kind of ecosystem gets you know, catalyzed and then continues to expand because it has not only a little bit of financial support, and these are small grants, they're not huge, but they make a big difference for these little schools, and they connect the community with one another. So they allow for that kind of collaboration and support. So that's another thing. And it's not just Vela, there's other, you know, kind of philanthropic organizations that are also really interested in how do we catalyze these low-cost innovative learning models across the country.
I'm going to look them up. That is very cool. I love that these exist, because I think in my head, I'm still like, oh, this is, I know it's still a burgeoning movement and it's still pretty new, but every time I find out about one of these, it's more exciting because it feels even more legitimized and established than I previously had thought. And I love hearing that kind of thing.
Yeah, and it's hard to know exact data now. There's a lot of overlap with homeschoolers, a lot of people, you know, who might attend a micro school 5 days a week, but would still technically be, you know, legally a homeschooler in some states. Other states, that's not the case. Others might not technically be a homeschooler, but might think of themselves as homeschooling. So it's hard to kind of weed out the numbers, but recent data from a couple of different organizations have estimated that anywhere between 1.5 and 4 million students in the U.S. are participating in some kind of micro school.
Really? Wow. That's exciting. I hadn't heard of even the word micro school until about 2 weeks ago when you had a New Jersey couple on your podcast. And I was like, what's a micro school? And I got all excited about that. And to hear that it's that big is so cool.
Well, and of course, this was, this micro school movement was happening pre-2020. It's the learning centers and programs that I detail in my Unschooled book are micro schools, right? These are programs where you can attend either part-time or full-time, up to 5 days a week. And we just didn't call them micro schools at the time. Mm-hmm. And I think, you know, even before 2020, we did start to see that term. We had growing micro school networks like Prenda Learning, and Acton Academy, of course, which were micro schools. But then the world discovered the value not only of homeschooling, but of micro schooling and other kinds of innovative models over the past couple of years. So now I think we're just off to the races.
That's exciting. What states are you seeing being more innovative policy-wise?
Yeah, I mean, it has a lot to do, education entrepreneurship has a lot to do with both the availability of school choice policies and the kind of overall regulation of education, innovation, and experimentation. So you mentioned New Jersey, we wouldn't think of as, it's not a school choice state. They don't have school choice programs, again, that enable education funding to follow students instead of going to school systems, but they do have this growing ecosystem of micro schools and hybrid homeschool programs and co-learning spaces. And, you know, part of the reason there, I think, is because New Jersey has some of the freest homeschooling regulations in the country. And so it's very easy to homeschool in New Jersey. It's among the easiest states in the country to do that. And because of that, we're seeing a lot of people like the people who run Village Electric, Ben and Tammy, who I had on my podcast, creating these micro schools and these schooling alternatives. And they're able to do that, again, because the regulatory landscape is really open to that. And in fact, I have a brand new paper out through State Policy Network that talks about how can we reduce barriers to education entrepreneurship in states, making it easier for education entrepreneurs to create these micro schools and similar models by removing these regulations and expanding homeschooling freedoms is one of those recommendations that I have in that paper. So we're seeing the kind of the fruition of that happening in New Jersey. Now, I think we're seeing the most education entrepreneurship occurring and innovation in states that have robust school choice policies. So that would be places like Arizona and Florida, and now West Virginia. They just passed the country's second most expansive education savings account program. So we're starting to see interest there. And New Hampshire, you know, states that have a track record of school choice policies, it enables families to be able to access additional options, and then it encourages education entrepreneurs to either create those options in their state or if they're another located in another state, to scale and expand into that new state that has the ability to have more families access this, because we're seeing quite a bit of parent demand for schooling alternatives. They want options beyond an assigned district school, and school choice policies enable that to happen.
Awesome. I wrote them down. We've got Arizona, Florida, West Virginia, New Hampshire. All right. Well, I'm going to start moving us towards the end, though I could geek out on this forever. Let's say a teacher wants to make that first step. I want to start a micro school or whatever that looks like, or a parent. But I guess let's keep it within an educator stint. So as a principal or teacher wants to make the jump, what do they do first?
Well, I can give a couple of examples. You know, one of the things we saw during 2020 was educators deciding to create these learning pods for their family and other families during the kind of school shutdown time. I think of, for example, Jill Perez, who's been a public school teacher for over 20 years in New Jersey. She more recently had worked in the higher education level, doing student teacher supervising of teachers in training. And she was one of these people who pulled her kids out of school in 2020, created a little learning pod, maybe what we would think of as sort of a homeschool co-op, but they were called pandemic pods in 2020. Mm-hmm. And that was so successful that then she ended up leasing a building and opening a microschool last fall with about 45 kids, multi-age. She recruited teachers, public school teachers, in many cases from New York and around her area in New Jersey, who were burnt out and wanted a change. And so that's one example. You kind of start small with a pod or some kind of co-learning community and then build interest and then ultimately find space. Other examples are, you know, teachers who just realize that they want to create a micro school. A big challenge for them is finding space. Zoning is a big challenge. That was one of the key findings in my SPN report around barriers to education entrepreneurship. Zoning laws in local jurisdictions can often prevent these innovative education models from emerging. So finding, you know, teaming up with other microschool founders or finding space with, you know, kind of collaborating with other people who share your vision is another way of kind of getting off the ground. Mm-hmm. And then letting families know that you exist. And I think, again, connecting with this larger community of homeschoolers or other education entrepreneurs like we're seeing in certain areas of the country can be a great way to find families, because there's so much collaboration and knowledge sharing. You know, one of the things I've found in areas where there are these clusters of education entrepreneurship, there doesn't seem to be a sense of competition. It's really much more collaboration. Mm-hmm. And because each of these models is so distinct and kind of tailored for, you know, toward the educator's own vision of what they want, it enables that kind of differentiation. And so, you know, micro school founders might say, well, you know, you can come to my school, but there's another school over here that's doing really cool things, or it might be closer to you, or it's more in line with what you're looking for. And so there's much more of that support and knowledge sharing. I've been really pleasantly surprised to see that.
That's great. I mean, that's, to me, seems to make sense. Why wouldn't you want to welcome that collaboration and competition at the same time, because it makes everybody better.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, where can we follow you, keep up with you and your latest thoughts and goings on for the listeners that say, I want to know more about Carrie?
Yeah, you can find my articles and follow me at the Foundation for Economic Education at fee.org/Carrie. You can also listen to my Liberated podcast wherever you get your podcasts, as well as on YouTube. Highly recommended. It's also at liberatedpodcast.com. And you can find me on social media. On Twitter, I'm at Carrie_EDU.
All right. Well, thank you so much for being on the program today. This was an excellent chat. I learned a lot already. I didn't know I could even learn even more, but I hoped so. And you definitely taught me a lot, and I'm sure the listeners will agree.
Oh, thanks, Ryan. It's been great being with you.
Thank you.